I think there are parts of the 70s that are actually not as good as the stuff that came out in the 90s, but maybe that's just because I'm a different generation.
No, there's so much bad comic booking in the 70s. In the early days of Marvel Superheroes, I read a fair amount of 70s stuff, and then my guys would not read it because I would tell them not to read it because I'd realize once I was reading it that this is just bad. You can see the pot stink comes off of so many of those comic books where it just like meandering bullshit makes no sense, and you get great stuff out of that. I'm pretty sure that Jim Starlin was high as a kite when he was doing Warlock, and that's the brilliant side of it. But then you forget all this other stuff where you're like, what was that shit? What were they trying to do with that thing? Oh my, you know.
I have the worst timing with comics too. Kyle Rayner is like one of the five things in my collecting life that I was ever there on the ground floor for. I always come in like right before it ends. It's just my luck. I would say I'm the Ten McGinley of comic collectors, but that would mean that actually the show lasted like five or six more seasons after I joined the cast, because like no one really understands how Ted McGinley works.
You're more like the Christopher Priest of fandom.
That's fair. I'll go with that. It's one of those weird things where I'm more writer-driven anyways. It's like I appreciate a fantastic artist, but I usually follow the story. So I'm more forgiving of most artists anyways, unless it's really bad. Like, whatever the hell was going on with Adventures of Superman when Joe Casey was writing the book, and they just went through bad artist after bad artist.
Which one? Was it Kano? Kano was one of them, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Kano did action.
Yeah, Joe Kelly. Yeah, see, that's what threw me off. At first, I thought you were talking about Kelly, and I remember he did a run with Pascal Ferry, and I really liked Pascal Ferry's work on the action, I think it was.
Yeah, to be fair, action was between Ed McGuinness on Superman and the Kano and the Pascal Ferry on action. Those were the good end of the Superman art at the time.
Yeah. Oh, for me, that was absolutely a Superman renaissance. I've never felt a desire to pick up the line of Superman books since, as much I did at that point in time, because Ed McGuinness, despite coming in late in life, Ed McGuinness is my Superman artist, with the possible exception of maybe John Bogdanoff.
It's funny because I didn't like McGuinness at first, but then I fell in love with McGuinness. Mm-hmm. It was like one of those things where I don't know about this, and then like three issues in, I'm like, no, this is actually really awesome. Yeah. This is everything I want in life right now, actually.
What I always think about is there's a blogger who, I swear, you stop blogging and then you stop reading blog, you know, and I feel bad about it, but Jake Caleb Mazzucato, who I think also used to do some stuff for Comic Book Resources. And I remember when Greg Capullo was going to come on to Batman, he was like, I don't know about this Greg Capullo. And I'm like, you're out of your fucking mind. This is going to be awesome.
No. Yeah, like when it was announced that Greg Capullo is going to draw Batman, I went, hell yeah, Greg Capullo is going to draw Batman. Because, one, Greg Capullo is insanely talented. I remember it was funny talking to Fabian Nicieza at Dragon Con this past year, because we were talking about when like the Image guys left, and he goes, his thesis, I'm not quoting him directly, but paraphrasing, he says, you know, they kind of left us in the lurch, but then again, my replacements were at Andy Kubert and Greg Capullo, so who am I to complain, right?
And I'll be honest with you, as much as I respect the artist that Capullo became, my favorite stuff of his is always going to be the X-Force stuff and the stuff that came before the Spawn era, because I just really loved his style when he had that little bit of a Michael Golden thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy the stuff that came out afterwards, but I love that period. And so I really never had any trouble with him doing X-Force, I gotta tell you.
Well, it's funny because that reminds me of two things. One, of going back to when they announced he was going to do Batman and the New 52, I'm like, that man could draw some capes, y'all.
Mm-hmm.
Like he drew Spawn for years. And while Spawn is not a direct Batman ripoff, there is a lot of Batman in Spawn's DNA. So let's be fair here. But two, I had a roommate in the 90s, a good friend of mine, that was heartbroken meeting Greg Capullo, because he fell in love with Capullo on Quasar.
Mm.
And he loved the way Capullo drew that book. And then he goes over to X-Force and it changes.
Yeah.
It becomes more energized.
He had a very feminine quality to his artwork in those early days. I think that maybe someone like Colleen Duran might have been an influence on him. And I like that stuff too. I didn't at first, but as he got stronger, I think I remember reading, I don't know who was talking about it, but they were talking about how it seemed like with every issue of Quasar, he got like light years better than the previous issue. And he just kept getting better and better and better. And you could see the deliberate progression in his artwork. But he definitely, his style changed dramatically by X-Force and then beyond.
So my friend assumed that Marvel made him draw that way. Mm-hmm. So when he met him, he's like, I'm really sorry that Marvel, you know, kind of made you change your style. And he goes, no, that's really how I wanted to draw. So it's like one of those things where sometimes maybe you don't want to meet your heroes because mm-hmm. they'll let you down a little bit. But no, I think...
with Ed McGuinness...
I lost my train of thought. I apologize.
Ed McGuinness was a guy that when he was working for Loeb and Liefeld over at Awesome, I was really appreciating his art style. I really enjoyed where his art went after he'd left Deadpool and he started working over at Awesome specifically. But I had no idea that I was going to work on Superman. It was a little... And of course, after all those years of Dan Jurgens being the standard for Superman, I could absolutely see where you'd have kind of a violent reaction to such a stylist as Ed McGuinness. But that guy does like one of the quintessential Superman and clearly won you over time. But you couldn't necessarily... I could absolutely see having a violent reaction to that because it was so different from what anybody else was doing. And the fact is, so many people who were fans of Triangle Era Superman, the dog for them was always John Bogdanov. And here you got a guy who's like even more of a stylist than Bogdanov. So I could absolutely see, you know, where you'd be like, what the hell?
Well, it's funny that I will admit I was one of the guys, especially since I started reading the Superman books in 87 and really haven't stopped, that when Boggs came on and Superman the Man of Steel came along as a title, I really wasn't into his style until after the death. And something happened with him and Jenke after the death of Superman where they went from being, I don't know if I like this, to, oh my God, this is fantastic. Like, there are shots in some of his issues of Superman that right now on From Crisis to Crisis, we're talking about the trial of Superman. Only John Bogdanov could have had a space pirate and make it look good and have Superman and a space pirate sword fighting in space on a ship that looks like a pirate ship. And it completely works. I love Ron Frenz to death. I love Stuart Immonen to death. That's not their wheelhouse. Well, maybe Ron Frenz.
I really enjoyed Ron Frenz's work on Superman too. And actually, one of my favorite Dan Jurgens written issues of Superman was the, I think Frenz drew it, was the Lex Luthor story, where all the machinations come to...
That was during the electric blue era.
The Countess and the mayor, where he gets the mayor assassinated. And it's
Mayor
like,
Berkowitz, yes.
Yeah, and that's when I was like, for a period there, I was like, oh my God, I freaking love Lex Luthor all of a sudden. How did this happen? But I love that issue so much. And I thought Frenz was great on that. But I really enjoyed his Superman.
Him coming onto that book, and like you were saying, you know, Jurgens had a very specific style, and Jurgens' Superman was big, but he was thinner than some of the other Supermen. So then to have the next guy come along be Frenz, who's very Kirby-esque in his designs and his layouts, they still look great. Like, yeah, his Clark Kent's a meaty human being, but he looks good. Everything about the book looked good. Frenz's storytelling was always super crystal clear. And I just think he understood that he understood the idea that when you have a character like Superman, you have to show the power. Mm-hmm. And McGuinness did the same thing, where you look at how the fight scenes were always dynamic. But he also was really good, McGuinness especially, was always really good about drawing the Daily Planet sequences as well. So it's one of those things where I don't know what my problem was. A friend of mine, a little after about 2 years into McGuinness's run, told me to check out his Mr. Majestic run that he did with Joe Casey. And I don't know if you've ever read that, but if you haven't, I would suggest picking it up if you find it.
Well, that's basically his audition, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was basically Joe Casey telling Silver Age Superman stories with Mr. Majestic, kind of doing what Alan Moore tried to do with Supreme, but with a less pretentious edge to it.
Mm-hmm. And better art.
That was the one problem with the Alan Moore Supreme run, wasn't it?
Janky art, because I like Dennis Janky's inks, but the artwork was janky on Supreme, and the joke is just sitting there, so I had to take it. the pun anyway. I don't know if I could qualify as a joke, but definitely a pun. I've yet to read much of Moore's Supreme, and part of it was because that artwork just, it was too much pastiche and not enough of actually capturing the power that they're trying to project by referencing the Silver Age stories.
And eventually Joe Bennett comes on to do the modern day stuff, and it was this really slick style, but every time they did a flashback, they tried to make it look like a Silver Age book. And that was my problem with it, is that I get that you're trying, you know, to show, you know, like, hey, comics were different in the Silver Age, but I like your stories, but I want the artwork to be a little more streamlined. This isn't what I was coming for, but, you know, again, maybe I wasn't the target audience for that. Of course, it was also the book that I remember people, I actually saw someone say something like this on Facebook a couple years ago. They're like, oh yeah, Supreme, the best Superman book of the late 90s. And I'm like, you son of... Yeah, it was during the Electric Blue era. I think time has been much better to the Electric Blue era than the New 52 in general.
New 52 is so terrible. Yeah. One thing I did like, though, is I do wish they'd done a little bit more with Hellspawn. I think that Hellspawn was actually kind of a cool Superman villain. And was it Ivan Ebon Reese that was drawing it at the time?
For a very brief period, yes.
Yeah, and that, given how much he recalls Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, I was definitely down for that.
See, I'm the guy that didn't think that the Wildstorm characters meshed well with the DC universe.
Oh, they don't. But I still, if you own those characters, you need to do something with them.
I mean, Hellspawn, of all of the Image villains, probably is one of the better ones to throw up against Superman. But it had that weird feeling like, I don't know if Superman's supposed to be fighting this guy. Mm-hmm. And of course, then it went nowhere.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a real bummer for me, because it felt like they were building it up. And again, I really feel like that... It might have been disinterest, but I also kind of think there might have been something legal going on, because they dropped that like a bad habit. I mean, they did that whole annual where they're getting into who Hellspawn was and what he was going to represent in the new DC universe, and then nothing.
You know, I kind of wonder if it's a combination of rights issues and the fact that editorial at DC at that time seemed to be in complete chaos. Like, if something wasn't working, they dropped it like a bad habit. And I'm wondering if ultimately it was Jim Lee that brought the hammer down on it. Like, maybe he didn't like what they were doing with it.
Yeah, no telling. Well, and this is another thing that's weird, though. Okay, Hellspont is an Acuren who was possessed by a Daemonite. Okay. And Acurens are owned by Rob Liefeld. Photon of Youngblood is an Acuren.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the Image guys seemed like they were doing handshake deals when it came to right sharing, and all their characters were appearing in each other's book. And then there's all that acrimony down the line, and you've got guys like McFarlane that just can't stop getting sued because all he did was handshake deals instead of making clear what was and was not work for hire. And so I've never understood how a character who's based in part on a Rob Liefeld premise can be published in a Superman comic at DC. And I've never been able to get an answer for how that could happen, especially now that Liefeld himself doesn't own that concept anymore. So now you've got, you know, Andrew Rev all up in DC stuff, potentially. I just don't understand how any of that would work legally.
My name is Michael Bailey, and I am still kind of a bad geek. Not a fan of anime, never seen any of the Harry Potter films, much less read the books. I ventured a little further into the worlds of Star Wars and Star Trek, and I've even managed to watch a little Doctor Who. I've also managed to not watch a single episode of The Walking Dead. So what do I like?
Comic books.
I have been reading and collecting comic books since 1987, and I've been a fan of superheroes for as long as I can remember. Some would consider this a hobby, but I prefer to look at it as what it truly is, a crippling addiction that I may never recover from. Back in 2007, I started a podcast called Views from the Long Box to deal with this borderline personality disorder. Every week or so, I pick a particular comic or issue or character or whatever to talk about them, and then... well, I talk about them. It's kind of what a podcast is. Sometimes I'm alone. Sometimes I'm joined by my semi-regular co-host, the Irredeemable Shag, or Thomas DJ, and the permanent semi-regular co-host, Andrew Leyland, and sometimes another friend from the podcasting and comic book world stops by to chat. The show is located at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com, where you can find old episodes and show notes, and links to my other internet endeavors. You can also find the show on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter under the handle
at Bailey's Podcasts. Views from the Long Box, a podcast about comic books or a desperate cry for help. You decide. Every Tuesday, or so, at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com.
John Byrne was one of the ultimate company men. You know, he was a guy who, as much as he loved Jack Kirby, to some degree sold him out when it came to, like, arbitration over his original artwork and the like. One of the only big names that could work with Jim Shooter for most of the 80s until he couldn't anymore. You know, it went from being, like, lockstep with Shooter to, oh, forget this, I'm gone, and you're fired off of Fantastic Four, and I'm off doing Superman. And where did that get John Byrne? John Byrne is one of the most influential comic artists of all time. The 90s came along, and nobody cared anymore. And he waited too long for his shot. He finally went off and did the Next Men. It was too late. And of course, he's got that long-standing animosity with the Image guys. And if he had just gone over to Image like Jack Kirby did, you know, he probably got one of the biggest paychecks of his life that he had left before I think he passed before Phantom Force came out. But I'm sure his estate got a pretty good check off of that, probably better than any single issue he ever did for Marvel after all those years, after all that commitment. And if John Byrne could have just sucked it up, joined off with these guys that revered him, that loved him to pieces, but he couldn't see past his own ego, he couldn't see past his own ideology, and he couldn't see that the company that he devoted so much of himself to, and profited handsomely for at the time, ultimately were going to betray him and leave him in the gutter just like everybody else.
Yeah, I mean,
the dude was doing freaking photo collage Fumetti Star Trek books the last time I checked, and they don't even do that anymore. This is one of the greatest artists ever, and he's cutting and pasting shit in Photoshop?
It's funny, though, because for a couple years there, especially when Jeff and I started from Crisis to Crisis, he basically put it out there that he wasn't ever going to do an interview about stuff that he's already done interviews about. Mm-hmm. And lately, he's been popping up on stuff. Mm-hmm. he did a Sci-Fi Wire interview about Superman, mm-hmm. where at the end, he basically said that if he could do it all over again, he wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, really? You know, there's a reason why I'm in comics, into comics at all, and it's you. So,
it's just like you're talking about with your friend, the Greg Capullo fan.
Yeah,
it's like, and this is a problem that this is a real hazard for creative people. Is creative people, of course, are always going to be their own harshest critic, and they're the most likely to dismiss their own work, not realizing that so many people have a huge emotional investment in their work, especially the stuff that was really, really popular. And mm-hmm. as much contempt as you may have for it, or as much, again, looking back through a jaundiced lens because of what happened at end point, but this stuff matters to people. And so when you take a work that you maybe are unhappy because things didn't work out the way you wanted them to, and you slag it, you don't realize that you're dealing deep wounds to people.
like he's like, you know, I never really liked my work on Alpha Flight, and you like cut to the guy sitting there with the entire John Byrne run of Alpha Flight crying because he loved it so much. But you know, the Image guy is just, I think nowadays, in all honesty, when people take shots at them, it's they're trying to do it for the lulls, because mm-hmm. I think there's a certain perception that the 90s were just all crap. And again, I'm biased, so I'll admit that fully. But I can also sit here and offer you arguments about why the 90s were actually a really good decade for comics, and why, especially if you were into DC Comics, is probably one of the better decades and more consistent decades out there. Because at least through the course of the 90s, DC evolved. And it was this is something I realized later. My problem with the Infinite Crisis era of DC Comics isn't so much what happened, and there are problems with what happened in some of the books, but I think my problem is that up until a certain point, DC seemed to be going somewhere, like as a company, as a universe. It's like it was evolving, you know, like Oliver Queen was dead, so Connor Hawk takes over, and Barry Allen's dead, so Wally West is the Flash, and Hal Jordan goes through what he goes through, so you have Kyle Rayner, and you know, you had this whole new generation of heroes coming up, and then at one point they just stopped that forward momentum. Now, what I realize now with the ability to look at it from hindsight is that you can only take that creatively so far until it's completely unrecognizable from what it was when people were getting into it. And I think the less they learned all the wrong drawn lessons from certain books. To be fair, it seemed like they learned, hey, if we just make this excessively violent, that's good storytelling. But I can't hate on the change anymore. But it makes me appreciate the 90s and the stories that were told in that era more so because I realized it was the only time they could do that. And really, when you look at, like, the Buziak Perez run of Avengers is considered a seminal run of that book. That doesn't happen unless Heroes Reborn happens, right? It's like they had to do Heroes Reborn to remind everybody that these characters were any good, because Captain America and that crew was forgot with the X Spider craze of the early 90s in Marvel. Though I would argue there's some good books even within, like, Captain America and Iron Man at that time. So
exactly, a lot of it's all a response. Liefeld will always happily remind everyone that there's never been a better selling Captain America book than the one he did, despite all the because it suddenly people wanted to know what was going on with the classic hero. And in trying to keep up the momentum that was built into Heroes Reborn, they had to go looking, okay, who can we get they could have some kind of heat behind them, but also would be a response to the criticisms. And so again, you go back to George Perez spent most of the 90s in absentia. He was one of the hottest artists of the 80s, and then even though he was still producing high quality work in the 90s, he wasn't producing it in the right places on the right vehicles. And because he couldn't keep up with schedules anymore, he'd burned a lot of bridges with the companies who were just less inclined to hire him for stuff. And he'd do stuff like he joined up with the Superman group, which didn't seem to work out very well for him. I think he was creatively stifled or what have you. And it just wasn't working for him. And so Perez was available, and you get like a classical style writer like Kurt Busiek after Marvels, and this is also after Kingdom Come. So there's a reevaluation of that the Silver Age revival that Busiek and Wade and Grant Morrison inspired. But again, that's a reaction to Image. It's a reaction to what happened in the 90s. You don't get to where we are now without going through what we went through to get to that place. It's like you can't disown the history, because the history got us where we are now. Now you can acknowledge the failings and where things went off the rails. Like, for instance, the blaming of Image for the entire collapse of the comic book industry. No, that I think most squarely is on Marvel's shoulders, because they're the ones who glutted the market. They're the ones who fed into the speculator boom. And unlike Image, they didn't have any content to validate that speculation. They just had flashy cover. They had the kind of gimmicks that you see now in our toothpaste boxes and things like that. But because it was a newfangled thing, they were selling you their crappy covers. But they had terrible characters. They had bad writing. They had bad artwork, and they were just selling you the hype. There was nothing but sizzle. There was no snake whatsoever. Say what you will about Image, the art was still pretty damn cool. Virtually everything about those books was great except for the writing. If they had not could see past their own hubris, they might have helped to save the Image industry, but they themselves didn't tank it. It was the reaction to them. But when you're talking about like your time period at DC, well, the reason why I was at DC Comics was while everybody else was focused on the art and the hot characters and the toy line and the cartoon, DC was the company where all the writers went to. I mean, there were some other more writer-driven companies. Valiant was as well, but those characters never resonated with me. And so the whole reason why I ended up at DC was because all these writers that I'd grown up with that used to be at Marvel were suddenly at DC doing the exact same type of storytelling that turned me on to comics in general, much less Marvel comics. And so that's why that was my home. And so when, Dick Giordano retires and dies, and Jeanette Kahn retires, and then you've got Paul Levitz trying to fight off Dan Didio and a whole new take on DC Comics, because they're still perpetually number two, despite being the better publisher, to my mind, the best publisher in the 90s, but they were still perpetually number two or lower. And so there was you get Dan Didio in there, who's got this perpetual need to try to prove how cool DC is instead of figuring out what makes DC work, always trying to show, how edgy they can be and how they're not your granddad's comics and they're not about wearing your underwear on the outside. And that which is a mentality that doesn't even make sense anymore, because nobody thinks in those terms about superheroes anymore. They dominate the landscape, and you're just still coming at it from the mentality of that guy who hides his comic books from his buddies at school because he doesn't want them to know that little geeky habit he's got. But basically what happens is you have this cultural change at DC, and the culture that invited guys like you and me in wasn't there anymore. And not only that, but the guys who were coming in were self-consciously trying to do something in opposition to what we were into. And you're right, you do have that trajectory. Well, where how long do we keep going with our Kyle Rayners and stuff? And frankly, in conceptual terms, Barry Allen as the Flash makes more sense. In conceptual terms, Hal Jordan makes more sense as Green Lantern. But when you spent a decade defaming Hal Jordan and convincing us that this guy should never be a Green Lantern again, and then all of a sudden all is forgiven and this guy's the Green Lantern, Oceana was never, we were never at war with Oceana. You know, it's like, wait, this is what I was programmed for.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there and just say that is the most amazing example of bringing in a literary reference in talking about how the evolution of comic books that I've ever heard in my entire life. Like, it came out of nowhere, and yet it makes perfect sense, and I know exactly what you're talking about. It's fun. Just a couple things to key off of what you just said. One, it does amuse me that DiDio can go, you know, our reprints are selling better than our new books. You know, that doesn't say much about your new books. Okay, what do you learn from that, Dan? And the answer isn't, let's do it like they did it in the old days, because that doesn't work. You can't go home again. There has been like one or two times where a creator comes back to a character and it's as good as when they were on the character the first time. So, living in Superman fandom, everyone says they just need to bring back Roger Stern and Jerry Ordway and Dan Jurgens. And I think you'd get good Superman comics, but you wouldn't get the Superman comics of the 90s. You would get their work now. And I think Dan Jurgens proved that when he came back to the character. So it amuses me, though, that DiDio is still stuck in that tooth. I think the problem is that his most successful books and his most successful time at DC Comics is now 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. What do you do with that, right?
How many times can you go back to what a guy like Alan Moore or Frank Miller did back in the 80s? You can make it flashier and you can make it sexier, but you're still just regurgitating the same thing. They're still living off of those past glories and not recognizing that the culture has shifted. It's like Andrew Dice Clay wondering, you know, why the PC police are coming in on him and that's why he's not selling shows anymore. No, you're not selling shows anymore because the culture has moved past your moment in time. Dan DiDio is still in that edgelord place. As a culture, we've moved past that, but he hasn't. But since that's the thing that's worked the best at DC, because they don't have their Kevin Feige or they don't have a Stan Lee, they don't have somebody who can legitimately either revolutionize them or figure out the thing that works best about them and just do that wholeheartedly, that's why they're still the number two guys, and they're perpetually the number two guys. They never want to figure out what makes them work, what worked in the past that went against the thing that made us work and got us some attention for a while there. Or they're always wanting to do the things that the other guys did that work, not recognizing that it worked for them because they came at it from an organic place and you're coming at it from a counterfeit perspective.
And as far as why the bubble burst in the 90s, and you know, like, people want to blame Image, people want to blame, you know, Adventures of Superman number 500. The thing is that, like any collapse of a structure, it is not one thing that brings the house down. You know, there was a bubble that started growing in the late 80s when suddenly comic books were cool again because the mainstream media was talking about it. You know, what do you always hear? Rolling Stone talked about The Dark Knight Returns. You know, so that gives it some cachet. And then Batman 89 happens and suddenly a comic book film is a legitimate blockbuster. And so you have these shops popping up all over the place and people start looking at it as investments. So you have more people coming into comics, some because they really like the characters and they like the stories and they think it's cool, but an equal number of people, I believe, that were there to try to make money off of it because Action Comics number one selling for this, so maybe I'll buy the next Action Comics number one, not understanding a lot of stuff in that. To feed that, Marvel and DC start pumping out product and more product and more product, and so all these shops start popping up because the people that decimated the trading card industry needed a place to go after they, you know, decimated that industry. So you have all these shops opening up, they're ordering all this product, and you know, I think Shags talked about this, that, you know, one day he had people coming into the store that he managed and they were buying all this stuff, and then one day and then the next day they just disappeared because they realized they couldn't sell this stuff like they thought they would. I mean, there's a shot in that Image documentary of that kid sitting on the ground going, I bought this book and it's signed and maybe I'll go to college with it. Well, you may take it to college with you, but I don't think it's going to pay your thing. So like all of these, it created a bubble, and a bubble can only go one place. A bubble does not expand infinite. It has to burst. And so in 93, it did. 93, the bubble burst. It took a couple years for the industry to really start feeling the effects of it. But really, that was the last gasp of that era. And so everyone blames the entire, you know, everything that was bad about comics in the 90s on the fact that the bubble burst when, one, it was foreseeable. Two, it wasn't just one thing. It's never just one thing. This drives me. I will agree with you that Marvel was a driving force of it. But if you don't have Marvel and the comic and the speculators coming in and Wizard Magazine, you know, those are like the three legs of the stool. And once one of those goes away, the stool just completely falls over. Now, Marvel's not going away. God knows Wizard did it.
But it got close. You know, it got awful close.
So it was the speculators. Because,
well, here's the thing, though. Okay, Shag has a different perspective than me, because Shag actually was a retailer during the boom, and he got to see the boom and he got to see the bust. I only ever saw the bust. I worked a few times for a flea market booth, you know, as a fill-in guy during the boom times, and you know, everybody stayed away because they didn't know who this guy was, you know. So I the 2 days I worked were slow days. When I started working in retail was after the bust had already happened, and so I'm coming into the industry while everybody else is going out of it. So my entire perspective on the industry was struggling to survive from the very beginning. It was still an industry I loved, and I enjoyed it much more than the work I was doing before that. But it was always, how do we make it by? You know, how do we pay the bill? How do we keep going in these bust times? And so the next thing that comes along, I think, was the Magic the Gathering. And I never played Magic, maybe a game or two, but I never really got that into it. And, you know, it was me with Scry Magazine figuring out what these things were worth, what I could sell them for, and people coming to us and saying, well, hey, this is a thing, you ought to get this thing. So I order it and I sell it, and it keeps the lights on. And then the next thing that comes along is your Pokemon or your Thai Beanie Babies. And the fact is, people were into that stuff. People, you know, I hear good things about Game of Thrones. And so, you know, after the first season comes out, I go and I rent some from Blockbuster, you know, rent a few discs, and we kind of dig it. And then me and the girlfriend start watching it, and it gets better and better, and it reaches its fever pitch. We love it. And then they run out of books to adapt. And then the next season's kind of rough, but exciting things are happening. We're still into it. And then the next season, the writing really starts to suffer. And by the end, it's like a hate watch. We're just barely getting through this thing because we've already committed to 7 years of this series. So we're going to go ahead and finish it. But by the end, we kind of hate it. So it's just like anything else. There were people who got into comic books who were loving some of this stuff, or, you know, they hear good things. And there's also the money aspect to it. And they go in there legitimately with an interest in it. And it reaches that fever pitch. They're buying a bunch of stuff they like, and they're learning all this stuff. They don't know what's good and what's bad. And there are things, you know, like we reread comic books that in retrospect were bad comics. They're not the ones that people want to talk about anymore. But when we were reading them at the time, we were excited about it. We were enjoying it. It didn't matter that they weren't good from the perspective of people that knew better than us. And the fact is, they liked stuff that was crap too. They just didn't know any better themselves and had gum up and built up a legend around this stuff that wasn't ever any that good in the first place. But ultimately, one of two things happens. Either you find the things you love and you hold on to those things and you stay in that you maintain that interest, or you just naturally lose interest because you're just not driving the enjoyment from it anymore. So beyond the speculators and the people who are profiting off of people's enthusiasm, you still had to have those people in the first place. You still had to have people who were genuinely interested in comics for a while there. But it was a very specific moment in time where video games cost a lot of money, and they were still fairly simple, and you could beat a video game over a weekend, you know, renting from the video store. And basically the technology shifted, people's interest shifted, and you had this last bright moment for comics before the medium just didn't have the impact, the appeal to a broad audience that it once had. And yeah, there, like you said, there's a whole bunch of other factors, but there's also just the simple fact that there's a time period where people genuinely got into it and then they lost interest in it. Just like I knew people that loved those Thai Beanie Babies, and they weren't just buying them because they were valuable. They just loved having stacks of the thing. I was talking to a lady who's really into the Funkos, and she's got shelves and shelves of Funkos. But just like us, at some point, you start to run out of shelf space and you start thinking, how many of these things do I really need? And that's when it starts to collapse. It's just your interest starts to fade. And if an industry is built on that interest and you don't have some kind of sort of diversification to help keep some so maintaining, it's going to just fall in on itself.
Yeah, there's one of those realizations that I came to after learning a term is that there's the either the hot hands or the free throw fallacy, where in basketball, if a player makes a certain number of shots in a row, the people watching it assume that he's just going to make all of those shots because he's made so many in a row. And I really feel like with comic book fans, they kind of adopt a similar attitude with what they're into because they think, well, this is awesome now. It's always going to be awesome. And it's art and it's commerce and things evolve. And I think we're the generation that just didn't want to let that go. I mean, let's face it, the guys before us, the guys and girls, I'm not trying to be sexist there, they just gave up when it wasn't fun for them anymore. It seemed to be easier for them to do that. And it's funny that you mentioned Magic and all that and that time period, because I got to be really good friends with the guy that co-owned the shop that I went to right before I moved from Pennsylvania to Georgia. And they opened their shop up in 1993, in the summer of 1993, the Jones brothers. Stan's brother's name was Tom. There was a guy named Tom Jones that owned a comic book shop. It kind of writes itself.
Yeah.
But they did one day shows like for years and then finally opened up a shop. And they opened it up, unfortunately, in 1993. But Tom started wholesaling Magic from the back office. And that's, I think, how they kept the lights on in that place, because it probably wasn't the comics after a while. And then eventually, of course, it closed.
And that's the funny thing, too, is I saw that happen so many times was, hey, this thing that used to be hot isn't hot anymore. We're just going to kind of sideline that or drop it entirely. And we'll jump onto this next thing wholeheartedly, especially if they're fans of that thing. And then when that thing fades, they don't have any diversity. So they just collapse. I saw that happen so many times with comic shops in particular, where they'd move on to that next thing and there would be nothing but that next new thing. And one of the reasons why our shops lasted as long as it did was because we always maintained a portion of that last thing. And of course, we would have our passion for the things that brought us into the store in the first place, and that's what would sustain us, where these folks in the short term might do better than us because they just go whole hog into that thing, but because they've only got the one thing, when it collapses, they collapse too.
Yeah, it seemed like the smart shops were the ones that could diversify and yet keep a like a mix of people coming in. The shop I went to for about 13 years down here, Titans, you know, sold comics, and that was a big part of their business, but they also did miniatures, they also did role-playing games, they also did whatever the collectible card game of the moment there'd be a tournament for on Sunday. Now, the problem with that was that casual people really couldn't go to the shop on those days because they were completely taken over by the people that came in just to play the game. And it was good for the shops because they were buying all their equipment and the new cards and the new dice or whatever paraphernalia you needed. But when Rachel and I first started dating in 99, she went up to Titans on a Sunday. And thank God, Chuck, the manager who I was friends with, knew who she was and kind of guided her through so that she didn't have to deal with the let's face it, they smell terrible. These people, this particular shop had people that just did not want to bathe, apparently. and when we finally got our dog, Boo, and we would bring her up to the shop because they would let her come in, we never put her on the ground because that carpet was old when they opened up the shop in 1983. And this was 2002. So we were afraid we would put the dog on the carpet and it would just disappear into it, like the carpet would eat the dog. But no, if you could do that, if you could crack that code, a shop could last a good long time. And I think it's fascinating that that's when you came into the business, though. Was at the tail end of the... Was it during the bust, or was it like right when the bust happened?
You're talking 93, 94.
So that's like right when the bust happened.
Yeah, and leaning more towards 94. So yeah,
which, to be fair, I mean, especially if you're talking about DC Comics, that was kind of a renaissance for them.
Oh, absolutely.
With Zero Hour,
Again, I've talked about this in the past, so if it's retreading something you'd already heard about, sorry about that. But the short version is that as X-Men was starting to lose me, in part because Claremont was re-energized by Jim Lee, and then I felt like as he was going into the new X-Men, he was starting to lose some of that. And then when he was gone, though, X-Men just wasn't the same anymore. So I started getting back into New Titans because of Titans Hunt and because of the renewed vigor of Marv Wolfman and the gorgeous artwork of Tom Grummett and Al Bay. And so Titans was sort of a gateway for me to trying more DC stuff. And I tried a bunch of different companies because, everything was coming out at that time. There's so much to try. And I gave everybody a spin at some point. I was the belle of the ball. Valiant and Image and Dark Horse Comics Greatest World and all that kind of stuff. And what ended up happening was Zero Hour came along, and I was just finding I was enjoying more of the DC stuff than anything else. And I just decided, you know what? I'm just going to take advantage. They're going to do a whole month of these Zero comics. I'm just going to buy all the Zero issues. And so I did, and there was stuff there that I liked and stuff there I wasn't so into. And so I just continued with the stuff I liked. And that was my primary inroad into DC Comics. And I was fairly fanatical about DC from 94 until into the new century because of the foundation laid out by Zero Hour. And that's why I'm so happy about Siskoid and Boss doing
yes.
a Zero Hour podcast. Yeah, because that was like my gateway. And of course, I'd read DC before that. But I read every single one of those books. So I know what I'm going to be into and what I'm not going to be into. And I'm looking forward. It's basically going to be an opportunity as I comment on that podcast to just relive and analyze that whole period since I was so immersed in DC specifically at that point in time.
Yeah, that was my, that was the moment. Zero Hour was the moment I went from being the guy that bought the Superman books every month and maybe another book here and there to starting to be firmly invested in the DC universe. Because I started buying, except for Legends of the Dark Knight, I bought all the Batman books and Catwoman. I didn't buy Catwoman, but I bought Robin and Batman and Detective and Shadow of the Bat. And I bought Flash and I bought Green Lantern. And eventually, as the decade wore on, especially when JLA hit in 96, I was like, okay, I'm going to start buying Wonder Woman and I'm going to start buying Aquaman. And oh, hey, they're starting a Martian Manhunter series. So that's going on the pull list. And actually, I had some letters printed in Martian Manhunter. Nice. Actually, funnily enough, Paul Hicks and I both have letters in the same issue. So,
so many literally things. Small world. You're on different continents.
Yeah, but no, that and again, I realize that there are people that grew up in the 70s, and that's their version of the DC universe or the Marvel universe. And the people who like were super hardcore into the 80s, you know, that's their particular bread and butter. And I realize that, but I also realize that objectively there are things about these books that I can point to and go, no, look, here's the thing. The great thing about the Wally West Flash series wasn't that Wally was a young version and like a newer version of the Flash, is that Mark Waid eventually developed a sense of legacy with that character that you loved seeing Max Mercury and Johnny Quick and all of, and like when he brought Jay Garrick into it. That's why I like Jay Garrick so much. I wasn't like a huge JSA fan until I started reading Mark Waid's Flash run. And then that was my gateway into the JSA because I didn't read Starman I picked up Starman completely in back issue form. So I got to, I didn't experience it on a monthly basis. I read the whole thing in like a couple of months. There were 80 issues. There was a lot to go through.
And it began with the Zero issue during Zero Month.
But I really think that if you look at like, especially the history of DC Comics, there's always periods of like a renaissance and then things just fall apart, it seems, quickly. And as almost like, so I'm sure there's a scientific principle behind this. The more it goes forward, the more those renaissance periods die out faster and faster and faster. Like everything now seems to be this dark metal thing. And this Batman Who Laughs. There's a Superman Batman title right now. I'm not buying it. That would have been anathema like 10 years ago. I'm telling you right now. But I just have no interest in a Superman Batman book that ties into an event I didn't read in the first place. Because I hitched my wagon to Doomsday Clock.
You get back to the whole Make America Great Again, which is mostly let's take everything back to the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And America, for certain people, was really great in the 1950s. But the problem is the specific set of circumstances that made 1950s America great for the people that it was great for aren't in place anymore. We don't have a post-war economy. You didn't have industrial lines bombed out for most of the globe, and this global dependence on American production. It's just not there anymore. And one of the things that's weird about comic books, because I've been doomsaying comic books at least since those days of trying to survive after the bust. What's weird about comic books is that the we're constantly losing audience. We had our golden age, literally in the golden age, and there's always been something else that comes along that does what we're doing better, and then we lose that audience. And so you look at DC in the 70s going into the 80s, you have to figure they probably lost a lot of audience due to Christ, because I'm sure a ton of guys mm-hmm. said, oh, you're turning DC into Marvel, I don't want this, I'm out. And so what ends up happening is you just have Marvel fans buy a bunch of DC books. And so the sales go up, but you haven't really grown the audience for comics as a whole. You've just borrowed an audience from another publisher for a time period, and hopefully can manage to maintain that relationship for long enough to sustain yourself. But the guys who read the Western comic, or the gals that read the romance comics, to be very gendered, but the odds are pretty good. When that got done better in other media, we lost that audience. And mm-hmm. comics have perpetually lost their audience, and we're at the point now where we're talking about a top-selling book is in the tens of thousands.
Yeah.
And the thing that I think most amazes me is clearly there's such a deep love for the industry that people bother to still make these things with such a minuscule audience, and that people are willing to pay $4, $5, $6 for a little pamphlet. Why? Because it's just some kind of OCD thing, and it's just this micro niche audience. But what's funny is we're at the point now where the thing that we used to have is the big budget visuals, because they always like to tell you, no matter what you're drawing, the page costs the same. It's ink and paper. Or these days it's all done on the computer, so it's the electricity that's running your tablet that you're working off of. But it costs you nothing to go as big as you want to go. It's only limited by your imagination. But we've reached a point where the storytelling that we all fell in love with in the comics, it actually does translate to film now. Increasingly, it's translating to television. The type of sophisticated serialized storytelling that we used to go to things like comic book for are being replicated in other media. So on the one hand, yeah, we're curmudgeons because I really want my Wally West Flash, and I really want my Kyle Rayner Green Lantern or what have you, because that's the thing that we were into, and we begrudge this generation that wants to do their thing. They want their Damian Wayne Robin. They don't care about our Tim Drake anymore. To some extent, we are those guys that got shaken off by Crisis, the first Crisis on Infinite Earths, but really everybody's getting shaken off, because as much love as we have for this medium, as much it still is useful in storyboarding these movies, we know what their purpose is now. That is their purpose, is they're relatively inexpensive R&D that pays for itself through a niche fandom that keeps getting ever increasingly smaller as the global population is constantly getting larger. The comic industry makes no sense because we never stop shrinking.
It's funny though, because I think what Endgame proved to me is that even the creative ebb and flow of a comic book will eventually hit these films. Mm-hmm. There's only so far you can go with the movies. Now, with in the case of the movies, because actors get older and want to move on to other projects. So, you're not going to have Robert Downey Jr. Anymore, because Robert Downey Jr.'s contract ended. Mm-hmm. So they decided to get rid of Tony, though, let's be fair, you can bring that back whenever you want to.
Yeah.
But I think what Endgame proved is that even in the movies, there's only so far you can go creatively mm-hmm. before you have to either start over again or go into a new direction. And it seems like the new direction they're going in is movies, but also television or mm-hmm. serialized television shows on a network of Disney's creation. So, and those can only go a certain level. It's interesting that you're absolutely right that now technically if movies wanted to do the same thing a comic can do, they could do it. It just depends on the budget and the willingness to go that far. are. But yeah, it's weird. It's one of those things that everyone hangs on to. Like I tend to get to be friendly with the people that own the comic shops that I go to, and there's still a really dedicated group of retailers out there that are just trying to make it through the current comic book climate. And you know, when you only have one major distributor and you're at the mercy of whatever the major publishers are doing, that's a it's an interesting existence to lead.
Very precarious. That's the thing with a comic shop, is that it's definitely a lifestyle, and you're going to make sacrifices, but it's also, you know, one of the best jobs you can have, because you get to spend all day talking about stuff like comic books that you love. On the other hand, some of the people you have to do that talking with, or just standing there and letting them talk at you, is also one of the worst things about the job. It makes you wonder why you sacrifice having a car or having this or that because you decide to stick with a comic shop instead. I can absolutely see why people would be willing to do that, because it's a lifestyle that, especially once you get accustomed to it, it's hard to give that up. It's one of the reasons why we shut down our shop, is because in my case, I could see that it was a trap, and if I didn't get out, then I knew what the next 20 years of my life were going to look like. And my partner had started working with her brother-in-law and making actual real money doing an office job, and finding, why am I still dealing with this comic shop? You know, I'm taking home more money by being a secretary than I am from owning a shop. I do think I've been saying forever, and the comic industry continues to march on. I really do think we're reaching a precipice, though, because I was hearing about Steve Jeppy doing reorganization over at Diamond and setting up Jeppy Family Enterprises or something like that. I look at what's happening at companies like Dark Horse, to some degree IDW, a lot of these Oni, you know, Oni set this weird partnership with Lion Forge, where they're still in separate parts of the catalog, but they're both like they merged essentially. And you see, like, you know, Shelley Bond's boutique at IDW closing out. You see, I don't know how well Karen Berger's books are doing over at Dark Horse, but Dark Horse, especially now that Mike Mignola's all but retired everything Hellboy related, it's pretty much the Jeff Lee Meyer company with some licenses, whatever licenses they've got left. I'm looking at what's happening with the industry now, and I really think in the next couple of years we're going to see another big collapse, because it feels like a lot of these companies are doing kind of weird stuff, and I look at this great big thick catalog. That catalog has stayed just as thick for like 20, 30 years now, and yet the audience is shrinking, and the audience is getting the stuff from different platforms besides going to a shop and buying the physical comic book. I've got this gut feeling like something really bad is coming up pretty darn soon. The Funko, we've been waiting on that to implode for a while now, and somehow they've managed to maintain interest, probably through having so many different diverse licenses. But I've just got this nagging feeling like something really big and catastrophic is on the horizon. So sorry, downer note, but I've been wanting to share that with somebody, because I'm reading the tea leaves. I'm looking at what the publishers are doing and what they have to offer and how well that's being received. It's like I feel like a storm's coming.
And the sad part is that I'm at a position in my fandom that if they, can't believe I'm saying this, if they ended all of the books I read tomorrow, I still have enough books to read my entire life.
Yeah.
And that's just the thing. And you know, the question is, could Marvel continue to exist, you know, not producing new stuff, but just like keeping Marvel Unlimited out there for and putting out trade paperbacks? And I don't know if they could, because then you have to rely on bookstores to carry it. And I think bookstores kind of weighed in on their opinion of graphic novels about 10 years ago. And they said, not as much anymore, thank you. Because Books A Million used to have like shelves and shelves and shelves, and they really don't have that anymore. It's kind of like looking at the manga section. Remember when manga took up like 3/4 of the bookstore?
Mm-hmm.
And then it slowly started shrinking?
But you walk into that Books A Million, and how much of it is novelties now and not even books?
Yeah, it really is. They are kind of relying on you buying tchotchkes,
mm-hmm.
You know, as well as books, and especially the trade paperbacks tend to go to clearance pretty quickly now.
And you go there too, and you've got a half price books and a Books A Million where you used to have a Barnes & Noble, you know? Mm. So it's not just comics. It's like, it's not just that they don't have the penetration of the bookstores. It's how many bookstores are there and how long are they going to be around too?
But on the plus side, I love the 90s.
Sorry. Took it to a dark place. Took it to
a dark place. It was a good conversation. I'm just also kind of running out of steam.
I could hear.
I apologize for that.
It's definitely the longest 10-minute abomination recording I've ever done.
Well, at least you can just take the abomination stuff and do it.
Oh, yeah. No,
do whatever you want with the other audio. So.
Again, you've got two people that are on the same wavelength,
mm-hmm.
and we're just going to keep feeding each other. You know,
yeah.
It's like at some point you're like, okay, am I enjoying this? Then I'm just going to stay along for the ride until the wheels come off. But you've got an hour on me, so you're pushing 2 now.
Yeah, it's almost 2 o'clock. So I've been up since 6:30.
Yes. Absolutely fantastic conversation.
Yes, sir.
Long overdue. But also, I can tell that you're just like, okay, this is great, but I'm dying here.
Yeah, it's literally nothing against you. It is all on the fact that I'm about to pass out.
No worries. Go pass out. I had a blast. You were just talking about how you kind of pulled back some, and I get that. But if you ever want to do it again, I'll be happy to talk with you again. If you got something you want to do, great. I've got hundreds of entries with a hot move. So if there's somebody in particular you want, holler at me, or I might be like, hey, you wanna take one of these on? So we're gonna do it again.
Alrighty, sir. I will talk to you later. This was a blast.
This was awesome. Great finally talking with you. I'll catch you later.
Alrighty, sir. Bye bye.
Superman never made any money, saving the world from Solomon Grundy. And sometimes I despair, the world will never see another man like him, the 108th Sage, Alan Middleton. Dr. Ange, ask what would Wonder Woman do? Bcode Django, Bone Dragon Comics, Chris Dunford, Chris Thompson. Collected Edition, DC Tweets, DeBased, Dr. Pop Culture, Dear Cashton, El Romero, Fanholes Podcast, Guido, Guy Not Guy, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, Paul Hicks, History of Comics on Film, Jeffrey Brown, Jesus Aranda, John from Married with Comics, John Boy, Just in Time with the JNT Baggers, Justice Rec 2020, Keith G. Baker, KSC, GSF, Podcast, Longbox Crusade, Longbox of Darkness, Mike at Sunday. Aliens to Me, Man, Nethead, Odell Abner Dracula, Pensatter Comic, Philip McAllery, Randy Caldwell, Richard G, Zero BB, Rob at Speculum Fight, Ryan Daly won't release his tax records either, Satin Tights, A Wonder Woman Podcast, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Sean Phillips, Shinji 70, Siskoid, Son of Cthulhu, Terrence Kistangwe, Time Price the Pod Crasher, Trekker Talk, Warlord Worlds, Who Added Wonderful, Wonder Woman, Warrior 4-Piece Podcast, and Xenozoic Xenophiles. Mike Lachlan wrote of the Angela's Marvelous World of DC Media episode, I enjoyed hearing your talk with Angela. When you responded to me last time I wrote, you mentioned that there was kind of a sameness to a lot of podcasters who focused on comics. I wholeheartedly agree, which is not to denigrate the quality of the podcasts themselves. It's just that most of us comic book fans, who like superhero comics, not necessarily exclusively, are middle-class white guys aged 35 to 65 who grew up in the suburbs. There's an echo chamber quality that can make me tune out. Yes, I know people like Bronze Age stuff, dislike the 90s, except Starman, Busiek, Wade, and maybe Morrison, unless they think continuity is paramount, and disparage the New 52, and a lot of Marvel's post-shooter output. That's fine, I'm looking for something else, though. Anyway, I'll definitely check out Angela's WW podcast. Kyle Benning wrote, in this episode you said each universe, Marvel, and DC, has its own distinct feel and aesthetic, which I agree with, and no writer is able to play in both sandboxes. While I think the list is few and far between, there are a number of writers that I feel have nailed both. Mark Waid, Steve Englehart, Roy Thomas, John Byrne, Dan Jurgens, and Jerry Conway, just to name a few that immediately spring to mind. If you disagree, that's fine. But then I'm curious which universe, Marvel or DC, you feel that each of these writers was better suited for? This set off a lengthy back and forth that I, the text-to-audio robot, am not being paid enough to interpret. We'll leave this section to Diabolu Frank.
To clarify, a good writer can produce quality material for either company. I don't think many can produce material for and consistent with the entire continuum of either company. You're either a Marvel Universe or a DC Multiverse writer, as inherent in your nature. Mark Waid has spent most of the 21st century writing for Marvel and produce some lauded runs, but he's a DC guy. He knows how most of the pieces of DC do and do not fit, and can write across their entire publishing history on most of their properties. At Marvel, it's individual books. Mark Waid has had years-long runs on some of my favorite Marvel characters, like Captain America, Doctor Strange, and Daredevil. I didn't like his take and avoided those runs. He's just not a Marvel guy to me, excepting Fantastic Four, which is weirdly a total outlier for Marvel. Steve Englehart is a Marvel guy. I mean, Millennium? Obviously had a beloved run on Batman, but who couldn't? Simultaneously, some of the all-time best and worst JLA work. Awful characterization. Green Lantern Corps was interesting, but ultimately killed interest in GL for years. Roy Thomas is a Marvel, because it gave a sense of history and continuity they needed to coalesce as a universe, while still trying to write like Stan. Pure uncut Thomas is Gardner Fox with more melodrama, which tanked his career when he switched to DC. Needs dichotomy to thrive. Dan Jurgens is very DC. Plot-driven. Big on heroic archetypes. Terrible at comedy and youth material. His only extended runs at Marvel were Captain America and Thor. That alone should tell the tale. Jerry Conway is the exception that proves the rule. He definitely has a Marvel soul, but it needs to be left alone editorially and canonically in a way Marvel doesn't allow. But he could freely write DC characters authentically Marvel style, without betraying their iconic qualities. Ultimately, Jerry Conway is functionally a DC guy, because he only works at Marvel on his books, not catering to anyone else's universe. Yet he could write any DC book synthesized with the popular Marvel flavor, but fared best when married to or contrasted against DC icons. Pop Culture Affidavit asked, Marv Wolfman? I replied, I thought Marv Wolfman was an odd omission. He's successfully written for both, and of course Crisis on Infinite Earths. Ultimately, though, he's a Chris Claremont. He rolled over a fiefdom within a greater universe for so long that he became incapable of acclimating outside of it. Kyle Benning replied, I didn't include Wolfman because, for me, he is the poster child of Marvelizing the DC Universe. He's patient zero of the Marvelication of the DC Universe, ultimately culminating in an actually straight-up killing the 50-year-old DC Multiverse. The whole premise of my question was writers that I felt worked well writing stories that fit in each respective universe and match their tones. While Wolfman's work is seminal, it's Marvel work done at DC, in my opinion, and thus was left off the list. Illegal Machine added, Get his ass, Kyle. I continued, John Byrne is a big-time Marvel guy. His whole thing was Marvelizing DC post-Crisis, which only worked commercially on Superman. All of his other DC material bombed. He just did a fanboy pastiche of Kirby's similarly poorly received DC work. Kyle replied, Yeah, we're pretty much in disagreement over how almost every one of these creators falls. I said, That's because you're a Marvel and I'm a DC. Kidding, I'm Image. And then Kyle added, I'm a dark horse.
Finally, Randy Caldwell gave us a thread of tweets. Spoiler for Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. Harley is not a bird of prey. Neither is Cassie Kane, which probably isn't her real name anyway. I'm sure somewhere there's a nearly mute person with that name, who is the daughter of Lady Shiva. I shall admit I have not seen The Phantom Menace, and I never will, unless I am on a bus riding from Atlantic City, when I can go to such places again. If that's possible, Darth Vader does not need a secret origin. The only interesting person named Skywalker was a rapper.
Rising up, cause on election day, we'll see who's banned in the USA. Banned in the
USA. I am not too pleased that Wonder Woman now has a dad. Being molded from clay is a classic origin. Then again, being a child of Zeus is a classic origin too. We'll see how much longer that lasts in the comics. Continuity changes as easily as the parallel world you are viewing. Then there is the fight over Metropolis, between the warrior General Zod, and an experienced Superman, who has had his new superhero job for less than a week. So there is collateral damage to the city. When Supes tried to take the fight off planet, Zod was not into that. To save lives, Supes snapped a neck. It bummed him, but he retains his status as the last son of Krypton, even though he just found out he was from there the other day. I shall now go and watch this week's episode of Harley Quinn on DC Universe, because we are all subscribers, right? Actually, the Phantom Zone villains didn't do so well in Superman 2, nor did they do well in the John Byrne Pocket Universe story. Bottomless pits and lethal exposure to gold kryptonite are not happy endings for these baddies. There is a reason Superman is the last son of Krypton. He doesn't tolerate the existence of other Kryptonians who are not his cousins and you.
The preceding program is a non-profit fan production. Any copyrighted materials contained therein are believed borrowed under fair use with no copyright infringement intended. Please feel free to leave comments at the Rolled Spine's Productions WordPress blog. You can also send us Twitter comments through the Rolled Spine Podcast Twitter. Thank you for listening.